I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The main American military hospital in Germany is reporting it's feeling the effects of the battle for Fallujah, expanding its wards to handle the 227 wounded flown in the last 3 days. Meanwhile, the Pentagon's official count as of yesterday of wounded and dead in Iraq, 1,149 deaths, 8,458 wounded. But critics, including officials of the American Legion, say the Pentagon routinely underestimates the number of wounded in battle, that thousands don't show up on casualty reports. Well, joining us on the line from Washington is Mark Benjamin. He's investigations editor for United Press International. And Mark, tell us, first of all, how does the military count the wounded?
The Pentagon counts only those soldiers who are killed or die in Iraq and the other soldiers that are actually wounded by the enemy, in other words, by the enemy's bullets and bombs. What the Pentagon does not count is the many thousands of soldiers who become sick, ill, injured in, for example, car accidents. If you want to understand how the counting of casualties works in this war, think about this Battle of Fallujah as an example. The first two soldiers who were killed in this Fallujah operation were two Marines who were driving a tractor. The tractor flipped over for a non-combat reason and landed in the water, and the two Marines drowned. The way the Pentagon counts casualties, if those two Marines had broken their necks and been paralyzed from the neck down and were on ventilators for the rest of their lives, the way the Pentagon counts casualties, we would never hear about those soldiers, and they would never be listed on any official Pentagon casualty reports.
Yeah, and you are one of those who report that there are 17,000 wounded in Iraq who have not been counted in official tallies. How do you come to that number?
What we've done is we have, at UPI, we have gone about trying to find out how many soldiers are put on airplanes and flown out of the area for medical reasons. And one of the things that we've learned is that 17,000 soldiers have been flown out of Iraq and Afghanistan for medical reasons that do not appear on the Pentagon casualty report.
And how do you come by those numbers? I mean, you're not on the plane counting.
Well, you can actually. If you ask the right questions, the Pentagon will tell you some information. If you ask the Pentagon how many people are injured that don't appear on the casualty reports, they say they don't know. But if you ask the Pentagon's Transportation Command, those are the people that are responsible for putting wounded and ill soldiers on airplanes, they will tell you their numbers.
Yeah. And are these, serious injuries, or did somebody have a terrible flu? I mean, how should we view those 17,000?
Well, unfortunately, the Pentagon is not giving us, or the Transportation Command, are not giving us any breakdown of exactly how bad off those 17,000 soldiers are. However, if you go and visit military installations, and I visited 8 in the United States and Europe, you'll find that there are some very, very serious injuries and illnesses that are clearly related to serving in Iraq that are life-threatening and long-lasting.
Wouldn't the military say that this has been a matter of time immemorial, that this is what has always happened, so that the military can sort out benefits and really get a sense of what's happening in war?
Well, what the Pentagon says is that they have traditionally only reported soldiers that are wounded directly by the enemy and soldiers that die in theater. However, I mean, as reporters, one of our jobs is to try to report to the American people what is going on in a war. And part of that, I believe, is trying to ascertain accurately what is the human cost of this war. My reporting shows that the human cost of this war is much, much greater in the thousands of soldiers than what the Pentagon is reporting. And so I think we have a responsibility to show that.
Well, we're going to speak in a moment to a Marine corporal who's fighting for passage of a bill that would keep full combat pay for wounded soldiers while they're getting treated but not yet receiving veterans benefits. There's a huge gap there. And I understand in your research you found other problems in coverage, especially when it came to mental health.
That's right. I had a drink the other night with a soldier who was recently back from Iraq who was evacuated for mental problems, post-traumatic stress disorder. Unfortunately, this soldier is a reserve soldier, and they're a police officer. The Army is not paying this person enough to pay his bills now that he's back from Iraq, but he can't go back to his day job because he's not allowed to carry a gun. Mm-hmm. So here we have a soldier who served his country. He can't go forward, and he can't go back.
A terrible story, but Mark, is there the money to pay the benefits for these wounded soldiers? Aren't there more wounded soldiers than ever returning from the battlefield because of the technology that's saving their lives?
I mean, there's no question that the Pentagon has gotten very good at moving soldiers quickly out of the battlefield. But the fact remains that there are many, many soldiers who believe that once they're off that battlefield, they're not getting the care that they deserve and they're not getting the benefits that they deserve.
Mark Benjamin, investigations editor for UPI. Mark, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Marine Lance Corporal James Crosby of Winthrop, Massachusetts, was injured in Iraq. And with the help of Massachusetts Congressman Ed Markey, he's pushing legislation to extend combat pay to wounded soldiers who've left the battlefield. The bill is called the Crosby-Puller Combat Wounds Compensation Act. It's named after James and another legendary Marine. And we spoke to James this morning on a bus on the way to Arlington National Cemetery for today's ceremonies. We started where his story starts, on that March day last year when he and fellow Marines came under fire, three rockets landing yards from their flatbed truck.
Well, what saved my life is this flak jacket that I had on, but right below where the armor plating ends, right where your lower back muscles are to the right of the spine, shrapnel entered my body and then going in an upward direction, hit my spine, and some of the shrapnel went on to hit my bowels. I had to lose some of my intestines, and then it kept on moving up. It cut my left ureter in half, which connects the kidney to the bladder, and then exited above my left third rib without even hitting my lung. So I consider myself extremely lucky. There's a lot of Marines, soldiers over there that aren't as lucky as I was, and just to be able to come home, it's a great honor.
Did you realize right away that you didn't have the use of your legs?
Well, kind of how it happens is I looked over my shoulder because I could hear them coming in before they hit. It just looked like three giant fireballs hit the ground. From then, just a big orange and yellow explosion. You could feel the blast all through your body. It kind of arched my back, and I just thought to myself, I wonder how these guys are going to react. I heard one of my corporals yell somebody was dead. Then he came over to me, and he says, Crosby, get up. And I was like, I can't. My legs don't work. And then the gunner started and yelled to the driver to drive to the medical station.
And so you went to Germany and discovered that you were paralyzed from, is it the waist down? Is that accurate?
I'm left with some use of my legs, my hip flexors, which you pick up your knees with, and my quads and hamstrings are still, I can still use those, still flex those. I hope within time, and as long as I keep on pushing myself, I'll be able to strengthen those muscles up enough to, you know, stand and maybe walk a little with them. Who knows? Maybe I won't have to have this wheelchair for very long.
Well, tell me, what were you making when you were in combat, and then what happened?
Well, basically, in the military, you get paid by your rank. They swipe your ID card once you've gone over to the combat zone. That shows the computer that you're entitled to all these extra benefits from being over there. Imminent danger pay, which is like combat pay, overseas pay, flight pay if you're flying, and if you hazardous duty pay if you work with explosives or whatever, which basically everything's hazardous duty over there. And once you leave that combat zone, whether it's because your tour duty's over or you're medically injured, your ID card still gets swiped through the system to let them know that you're not there, and your pay rate goes back down to what your rank is.
So what your proposed bill will do, it will enable injured soldiers such as yourself to keep their combat pay. You, for instance, were at $2,500 with combat. You dropped to $1,300 when you were injured. And this will help close that huge gap. There's a long wait during recovery before soldiers are given either disability or discharge pay.
And that might help to speed up the discharges, because there's some people that are still waiting to get discharged, and they can't seek veterans benefits until then.
Why can't soldiers who have, you know, lost a limb or are lying in hospitals getting physical therapy, why can't they get discharged quicker and get those veterans benefits?
Well, see, you have to go through a medical evaluation board. They have to review all that, and then it's got to go through a bunch of red tape. I was fortunate enough to get mine in about 6 or 7 months. When I was awarded my Purple Heart in Bethesda, the assistant commander said to me, if there's anything, you know, I could do for you, let me know. Well, I let him know, and I needed that discharge, and he definitely came through.
Well, why,
a lot of people, I don't think, though, when they hear that, they might not take that up, and they just let it pass. I wasn't going to let it slide because it's hard being in a veteran's hospital and trying to get the same veteran's benefits because you're not a veteran.
But as you're saying, if it's a card that slides in a computer, maybe all of that can be changed.
I think so. I mean, I can see how they want to be keeping tabs on you. When you're in country, they're going to swipe your ID card to let you know you're there. When you're going out, they can still swipe it. But I don't think that it's right to take away that valuable money that you're going to be getting paid over there because you're fighting for your country, because you haven't stopped fighting. Now you're over there in the hospital fighting for your life.
How tough was it for you and your wife to live on $1,300 a month while you were in the hospital?
Just dealing with your day-to-day expenses, you have to move your life cross-country. I was stationed in San Diego, California, Miramar, and now we had to move back to Boston. Cell phone bills going out crazy. You're obviously not staying on top of the bills. Because I know this bill is going to go through, it has to. When this bill goes through, it will help everybody that's coming back, because I was fortunate enough to have the support of friends and family to bring me through this. But there's the people out there that don't have anybody. You kind of wonder where you fit. And then to have an injury that changes your whole life, we need to support these troops and welcome them back into society. Mm-hmm. And it's just great to see that the media is actually showing what's going on over there. So that maybe everybody, some of the people that are just comfortable and take things for granted, like a lot of us do, can actually see what the cost of freedom is.
James Crosby, before you were injured, did you know that there was a gap between the combat pay that a soldier received in the field and the veterans' benefits and disability checks that they received long after, that long recovery period? Did you know that?
Well, you don't really worry about or ask questions about retirement if I get hurt, this and that. Right. We do know that when you're in the combat zone, you get paid extra, and when you're not in the combat zone, you don't. But you kind of just assume that, hey, if I get hurt, the government's going to take care of me.
Are you angry at your government for, this gap in care for soldiers?
I'm not angry at the government. It's a hard job to run America. Rules written a long time ago, but rules need to be changed with time. My father and my family and me, we're just the ordinary person, but we saw that this was wrong and we had to do something about it. And first and foremost, I have to say that I love my country and I love the Marine Corps, and I would never say anything bad about either.
James, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
I know you're hoping to see President Bush. Are you going to try to talk to him about this?
I would love to talk to him about it. Believe me, if I have enough space for my wheelchair to roll over to him, I'm going to go, because it's one thing that I learned in my whole 20 years of being alive, is if you don't take advantage of the situations or those short times in your life where you can get something done, they're just going to pass you by. And I don't care what position anybody holds, I'm not going to let that intimidate me. I have something to tell him, and if I can get this message across to him, it would just be great.
Marine Lance Corporal James Crosby on a bus on his way to Arlington Cemetery for today's Veterans Day ceremonies. James, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Okay. His whole 20 years. Well, just ahead, funeral preparations are underway for Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. Yasser Arafat's body is being readied for his funeral tomorrow in Egypt. The military-style funeral will be held in a mosque on the grounds of Cairo's airport. Afterwards, his remains will be flown to the West Bank for burial outside his ruined headquarters in Ramallah. Arafat, a Nobel laureate who embodied the Palestinian struggle, was also seen by some as a terrorist and a roadblock to the peace process. Joining us on the line from Tel Aviv is Boston Globe correspondent Charlie Radin. And Charlie, you've just returned from Ramallah, where we're hearing that reaction to Arafat's death is somewhat muted.
To say the very least, there were attempts to get a big march and demonstration going in Ramallah today and never managed to get more than, charitably, never more than 300 or 400. And it was all teenage boys and young guys in their 20s, some of them dressed as militants and shooting pistols in the air, and they just couldn't get up any excitement.
We've been hearing from you and other reporters that there's a sense of, for the most part, a sense of relief that the wait is over and an interest in sort of perhaps now moving on to getting back on the map to peace.
I think so. I think that there's sort of an idea that we're going to honor Arafat, but it's in the sense of, honoring the end of stage one and beginning stage two, as one Palestinian put it to me today. You know, stage one couldn't end of their national struggle as long as Arafat was alive. And I think they know that stage one's time has gone.
Before the burial, the funeral will take place in Cairo, Egypt. Who's expected to attend?
Not that many heads of state, as we understand it so far, from the Arab world, only Egypt, Jordan, and Yemen. But this is truth in packaging. You know, Arafat was not popular among Arab politicians generally.
We know that many foreign ministers from other countries are expected to attend, from Britain, from France. What American officials might attend?
Well, we've heard possibilities of Satterfield, I think he's called Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for the Near East, the Consul General in Jerusalem, who effectively serves as the U.S. Ambassador to the Palestinians. And I think that's about it for officials. Jimmy Carter is said to be interested in going, but I think it's, in a sense, more interesting that Bill Clinton, who was much involved in the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, made a quite non-laudatory statement on Arafat's death and apparently won't be coming.
And Yasser Arafat received his Nobel Peace Prize. He shared it with Yitzhak Rabin and Shimon Peres. Rabin, of course, dead. Any chance that Shimon Peres might attend?
That's a very good question. I would guess he'll try. You know, he made a very nice statement that the Palestinians took note of as Arafat was dying, saying, whatever you thought, you shouldn't celebrate his death, and you should respect the feelings of the Palestinian people.
Boston Globe reporter Charlie Radin speaking to us from Tel Aviv, having just returned from Ramallah. Charlie, thank you.
My pleasure.
The Massachusetts Attorney General's Office is joining a Mass Turnpike Authority investigation into the cause of hundreds of water leaks found in the walls of Boston's Ted Williams Tunnel, a key component of the massive Big Dig project, the largest public works project in U.S. history. This all comes after a new report from an independent engineering consultant showing that several tunnel wall panels could have been repaired back in the 1990s. Here and now's Audie Cornish has more on the story.
At the Mass Turnpike's Nealon Street headquarters, dump trucks are still running gravel, and the steel beams and cranes at its entrance serve as a reminder that the new Interstate 93 is nearly finished. But the Big Dig tunnel running under the city has sprung a leak. In fact, it sprung several hundred. And now it's drawn the attention of State Attorney General Tom Riley.
This was supposed to be a finished product that was delivered, and the company was hired to do a job. The people of Massachusetts, in fact, the people of the United States who paid for this, expected to get what they paid for. And certainly they didn't expect to get a tunnel that leaked. I mean, you know, that's not a small thing.
State Turnpike Authority officials say the highway and tunnel system is safe and structurally sound. But minor defects sprinkled throughout the tunnel's walls are dumping millions more gallons of water into the tunnel than its drainage system is designed to handle. 2 months ago, one of these leaks burst through the tunnel wall, causing an 8-inch hole to gush water into rush hour traffic. This flood created a 10-mile traffic backup. As a result, the tunnel's walls and the project construction records have come under intense scrutiny. Turnpike Authority Chairman Matthew Amarello.
That this particular slurry wall is not the quality we were promised by the contractor, nor the quality we expected. While some water seepage and small leaks are inevitable when dealing with tunnels, there should be no breaches of the kind that we suffered in September. It is simply unacceptable.
According to independent consultants, construction engineers noted the clay, sand, and other debris currently contributing to the leaks back in 1999. But there is no sign that principal contractor Bechtel Parsons Brinckerhoff or its subcontractor, Modern Continental, reported the defects or tried to correct them, according to the report. Executives at Modern Continental released a written statement defending their work on the project. Engineering consultant and author of the report, George Tamaro, describes the problem as unfortunate but not disastrous.
I don't know that they were sensitive to the magnitude of the problem they were creating. So, you know, it's been my experience that when you encounter a problem in the execution of the work, fix it then. When you're still at street level, it's an awful lot easier. And that that step didn't appear to take place?
Turnpike Authority board member Jordan Levy says he is determined to ensure the mistakes are corrected, and he says it will be the contractors, not the taxpayers, who will cover the cost of repairs.
We're going to hold the people responsible. We're not going to get scapegoats. We're not going to find some political answer here, and we're not going to point fingers. We're just going to hold people responsible for what they were hired to do for a change, and that's going to be unique in Massachusetts.
Consultants say the leaks in the project, already marked by billions of dollars in cost overruns, could take up to 10 years to uncover and repair.
That story produced and reported by Here Now's Audie Cornish. Tomorrow on Here and Now, there are over 600 terror suspects being held at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Some have been there almost 3 years, including Chinese Muslims still held at the prison because U.S. officials fear their lives will be endangered if they're released back to their homeland. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. Robin Young, it's Here and Now. This week we've been looking at the Canadian healthcare system, taxpayer-funded, available at no cost to all Canadians, and much admired by many Americans. But today we speak to a Canadian doctor who's part of a small movement to privatize Canadian care. Dr. Luc Bissette has opened up a new private clinic in Montreal, which operates outside of Canada's vaunted public system. It's called the MD Plus Medical Clinic. We asked Bissette why he and his partners, all former emergency room physicians, decided to strike out on their own.
We didn't feel we had all the means necessary to give a good practice and give the attention to our people. And we have to fight sometimes with the system because, you know, in Canada, everything, at least in hospital settings, is public, and so you don't have to pay for it. That is true, but the way the administration controls the budget is that they have an envelope at the beginning of the year, a financial envelope, and they try to conciliate everything inside it. So actually they're using waiting lists in some ways for management.
Oh, Doctor, you have to explain that to us. So you're saying that they start with an envelope with money in it, this is sort of a metaphor for the government's budget for health care. And then what are you saying, that they want to go slow on surgeries because they don't want to use up that envelope too soon?
That's not the way they would explain it, but that in practice, what it means, because director of hospitals do have that certain envelope, okay, and they are asked not to go beyond it, and if they had that kind of volume of operations last year, then if they do much more, if they have an increase of 10% of their operations in the following year, then they're going to be in a deficit. And so urgent surgery and all that is never postponed, but elective surgery sometimes is. So actually, right now in Canada, for example, if you look at orthopedic surgery, sometimes from the moment a physician sees his GP to the time that he does have his treatment provided, it could take up to 8 months. And during this time, actually, the people might be incapacitated, and that cost is never actually accounted for.
Well, I know you feel you offer more time to spend with your patients, better quality care, faster care, faster minor surgeries, let's say. But How does your system work, doctor? I mean, you charge patients what they get what?
Let's say if it is a minor consultation of about 20 minutes, it's going to be something like $100 Canadian. If they want to have a single appointment plus lab test and imaging, obviously the cost of the lab and the imaging is in plus. And we do have programs also for people that need six or seven visits because they're diabetic or they have another medical condition that should be monitored closely. Then we have a program which is we see the people, we do their workup, we see them again in follow-up visits six or seven times during the year. We do provide also a 24-hour, seven days a week assistance by phone if they have a problem because we do have a computerized medical record. And for that, it's about $1,500 a year.
You would charge your hourly fee for minor surgery, stitches, things like that, maybe setting a bone, you know, emergency room procedures that, as you had done before. But if somebody needed a hip replacement, they wouldn't get
obviously,
that with
we
you.
We cannot do it in our clinic because we are GPs and we are not orthopedic surgeons. But we know an orthopedic surgeon which has opted out. And the difference is that that orthopedic surgeon, instead of being having a waiting list of about 4 or 6 months to see a patient, could see the patient, one of our patients, in 1 week or 2 weeks at the most. And if surgery is required, it's usually done inside a month.
But that surgery costs how much? And they have to pay for that, right?
Yes, they would have to pay for that. It depends. I don't have the fee schedule of my colleague, but I think it's something in the order of 5,000 or 7,000 Canadian, which is about 5,000 U.S. For surgical operation. And your following question would be, yes, but are there only rich people that do actually use that surgery?
That's right.
The answer is no. And that's one of the very hypocritical thing in the Canadian health system, because it is already a two-tier system, but only for the privileged that are well-connected. So
What do you mean? What do you mean? In other words, you're saying that in Canada, even with the free government-backed system, the wealthy people, get in sooner?
In some ways, yes. It's something which is not obviously publicized, but if you have a large donor to a foundation, for example, usually the hospital foundation would help you out if you have a problem. And sometimes, actually, you would have a special attention.
But what do you say to the critics of what you're doing who say that you're going to undermine the system and make it more of a two-tier system even more, because the wealthier Canadians will pay for their private medical care and the poorer will be in the government system?
It's not true at all. Actually, as I told you, the very rich or well-connected people have their ways inside the public system. They end up being served faster and actually freely also, which is astonishing in lots of ways. It's mostly the middle-class people that are not well-connected and that are not large donors to foundation that have that problem. For example, that's a question that I asked before to my colleague with the orthopedic surgeon, because his procedure are $5,000 to $10,000. And I asked him, are there only the rich people that are requiring your service? And he answered me, no, on the contrary, there's a lot of middle-class people, and they have to choose sometimes between their priority, whether they go for a trip in winter vacation for 1 or 2 months in Florida, and then they wait for their hip replacement or knee replacement for 1 year and 1 year and a half, or they just cancel their trip, which is not necessarily. They have their surgery done, and their surgery is done in less than a month. Mm. So it's a choice. It's a freedom of choice which is given to people. And that's the same in a lot of countries in the world. If you look at France and Germany, that have as good figures in public health as Canada, and sometimes even better, they have two systems where the public and the private do coexist. In Canada, we made it a religion to have a totally public system, to the point that actually for us, for example, we cannot at the same time, even if we would like to, work in the public system and go on doing some emergency room work inside hospitals. One of the things that was extremely frustrating in the public system, which is huge because you're talking about a $20 billion health care sector in Quebec alone. It's just like a huge company. Mm-hmm. To move something takes a heck of a time. And it kills in lots of ways the creativity and the productivity of the people that said at some point to just give up because it's too difficult to move things around. And one of the things that we realize working in the private sector is that actually we are able to use our own creativity, our own incentive, our own imagination to try to make things work. And that's why I think in some ways private and public have to work together because one could actually complement the other.
Dr. Luc Bessette, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Dr. Luc Bessette, who's opened up a new private health clinic in Montreal, Canada. And still to come, Augustin Burroughs, best-selling author of Running with Scissors and Dry, and now he's got a new book that's already climbing the top 20 list. You're listening to Here and Now. Today is Veterans Day, but it was originally called Armistice Day to commemorate the day that World War I ended. That war to end all wars was a brutal conflict, costing the lives of 117,000 American soldiers and sailors. Producer Lester Graham has this remembrance.
Europe had been at war for more than 3 years by 1917 when President Wilson and Congress decided to send American troops. The propaganda machine started grinding right away. There was no radio yet, but luminaries such as General Blackjack Pershing, who led the American expedition, made recordings that were played on phonographs in fraternal clubs and town halls back home.
3,000 miles from home, an American army is fighting for you. Everything you hold worthwhile is at stake.
Well, they told us we was fighting for democracy, and a war to end wars. That was what they tried to brainwash the people with, you know.
George Thorworth was among the first American soldiers to ship out for the war. In this interview recorded in 1990, he explained that, like thousands of others, he had volunteered alongside his friends and neighbors.
Americans, they wanted to end that war. They didn't want to be over there forever. We just enlisted for the duration, you know.
Over there.
It was supposed to be a grand adventure, but after landing in France, the doughboys quickly found their dreams of glory mired in the brutality of trench warfare. Technology helped make an incomprehensible level of carnage possible. Improved artillery turned forests and pastures into cratered fields of mud and twisted barbed wire. All kinds of new contraptions killed men in gruesome ways. And one of the worst new weapons was the poison gas attack.
I think the most vivid one I can remember is the time I had patrol out, and we had 260 men in the company, and there was only two squads left after the gas attack within for 48 hours, and our gas masks weren't good for only about 24. And you go out on patrol at night, and you stick your arm into the dead bodies and stuff. It was terrible up there at that time.
The troops were always short on supplies. Sometimes in the trenches for months at a time, their clothes rotted away. Thorworth says his leggings, socks, and underwear fell apart, leaving him with nothing but a shirt and pants he had to pin together. Food was short. They ate whatever was available.
All our artillery stuff was drawn to horses at that time. When a horse get killed, we'd have slum to eat.
World War I was to end November 11, 1918, Armistice Day. Veterans of the war crawled from their holes and trenches, found a bottle of wine or cognac anywhere they could, and celebrated surviving. 8.5 million soldiers and sailors had died, 117,000 of them Americans.
Eyes of gold, star mothers, sisters and brothers, what a sacrifice they made. I saw one-legged pals coming home to their guns in my dream of the big hooray.
In his book, The First World War, Keith Robbins writes, huge numbers of crosses peopled the silent landscape. From all over the world in years to come, relatives and friends trooped through these uncommunicative cities of the dead. The cemeteries of Europe housed them, for in the end, there was little to be said for trying to bring the fallen home. It is just as near from France to heaven as from Indiana, concluded one mother.
Our remembrance of the veterans of World War I was produced by Lester Graham. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Wasted and wounded, it ain't what the moon did. God, would I pay? A couple of bucks from you to go waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, you go waltzing Matilda with me. I'm an
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Best-selling author Augustine Burroughs begins his new book, Magical Thinking, True Stories, with a story about Tang.
When I was 7, I was plucked from my uneventful life deep in darkest Massachusetts and dropped into a Tang instant breakfast drink commercial. It was exactly like being abducted by aliens, except without the anal probe. I was a lonely kid with entirely imaginary friends. I played with trees. Then, one day during penmanship class, a white van pulled up in front of our little gray schoolhouse, and the men from Tang climbed out.
Augustine Burroughs reading from his short story, Commercial Break, from his new collection, Magical Thinking. This is his fourth book and follows his two critically acclaimed, often hilarious, frequently disturbing memoirs, Running with Scissors, that's the true story of how Augustine's mother gave him away to a lunatic psychiatrist, and Dry, his subsequent battle with alcoholism. You'd think that would be enough memoir for anyone, but then where to put the essay about how he got into a Tang commercial, or the story of how he willed his boss to die? Hence, this new collection of essays, and author Augustine Burroughs joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, you know, things do happen to you.
Things do. I don't know if it's like I have a high iron content in my forehead like a pigeon, and I just attract this kind of stuff. I mean, I didn't set out ever in my life, you know, to have bizarre experiences. I just want it to be normal, you know, painfully normal. And yet life, the universe had different plans in store.
Well, you know, and that brings us to the title. You didn't set out, but you certainly willed from an early age. You tried to will your life in certain directions, like influencing those Tang commercial ad execs who you hilariously described. They're like Ghostbusters coming to your school. And you willed yourself into that commercial, and you tried to will yourself out of your birth family, and you sort of did, in a way. You just seem so desperately trying so hard.
You know, that's a quality I think I've always had, and it's funny. I mean, you talk about how I willed myself into the Tang commercial, and that really is exactly what I did when they were auditioning. You know, in my mind, I was going to get in that commercial even if little Janie had to fall down the steps. You know what I mean? I mean, even if there was like pencil injuries, I would be in that commercial. And of course, I couldn't will myself from being, you know, lifted up off the cutting room floor as it happened.
Yeah.
But I've always been like that. I've always been very, very much looking forward to a better time or a better place, you know? And it's actually what kept me afloat during, I guess, my running with scissors years when I was living, you know, just in sort of a terrible, terrible kind of situation.
Well, I'll say, let's, you know, for those who didn't read that, you know, huge bestseller, Running with Scissors, I was amazed. I was three quarters of the way through this new book, and I realized, wow, he hasn't really said outright that his mother gave him away to this, you know, bizarre shrink who lived in squalor with a pedophile who abused you. I mean, you don't really say that outright. But it's the background for everything.
It's become the ether, you know, that I sort of float around in. That experience, I mean, being left by your mother with a family, and a family that was different than every other family, almost like a cult, it either breaks you or it makes you stronger. I mean, I guess that's sort of a cliche, but it's true. And, you know, more magical thinking comes into play because I was determined to be okay.
Magical thinking is a real term?
Yes, it is. It's actually it's a term that psychologists use to describe people who believe they have more influence over events in their life and in the world than they actually do. So some patients who have, you know, extreme magical thinking might believe that, you know, if a foreign president dies, that, you know, I had something to do with it because I willed it to happen. I mean, that's like a pathology. It's almost like a psychosis. But I think of like magical thinking light as something we all do.
Well, now, in fact, let's skip ahead because you are sober. You have a boyfriend, at least towards the end of the book.
Oh, yeah, we've been together for years.
You and Dennis, who seems to love you very much.
Yep.
And so some of your many fans would say, wait a minute, what are you going to write about?
You know, I know, right?
Because even you at one point say, hey, I got an idea. I'll give him a manuscript about my terrible childhood. That'll sell. And it did. But, you know, then what?
Right. You know, Running with Scissors and Dry, those are both memoirs. You know, they tell basically one story about one part of my life. Well, that's just two out of, you know, a lot of stories. So, I mean, if I wanted to, I could be totally like a hot dog factory here and just crank out story after story after story. And, you know, I guess I probably will unless, you know, fate has a wayward bus, you know, in store for me when I leave the studio right now.
Right, because it's worked so far.
Right.
But a couple questions for your many fans. Your mother that you've written about so much,
right.
How does she view this?
Well, my mother, you know, I don't know what her honest feelings are. I mean, I know when Running with Scissors first came out, she was upset, and she was upset for a number of reasons, not all of which she expressed. I mean, I think one thing was my mother was a good poet, and she wanted to be a very, very famous poet, and that didn't happen for her. I think that must have been very hard. And then if she had written Running with Scissors, it would have been about a brilliant artist raised in the oppressive South who married the wrong man who oppressed her further, and she finally found a liberating, untraditional psychiatrist in the 70s who not only freed her creative unconscious but took responsibility for her child and gave her the time and the space that she needed to, you know, become big. Mm-hmm. And that would be her story, you know, and mine is like, my mother ate sardine and cigarette butt sandwiches and, like, had a relationship with the minister's wife, you know, and like, didn't tell me and then gave me away and sort of washed her hands of me, you know. And both are true. I wrote a book, you know. Maybe she'll write a book.
Yeah. What about the other question that I know you hear a lot? Let's just dispense with it. The David Sedaris thing, another openly gay, very funny and often tragic writer who tells his own story. You are compared to his writing all the time. What do you feel about that?
I'm flattered by it. I think that I admire David Sedaris, and I think he's – not only do I think he's very funny, but I think he's an incredible prose stylist. I mean, if you read Mr. Sedaris' work just sort of page by page – and I read him very slowly now, and just the crafting of his sentences is really beautiful, you know? And I think that a lot of people read him quickly, and they that's why they say, oh, he's so funny. And he is so funny, but he's also an elegant writer. Mm. And I mean, that's something that I personally aspire to, is to have an elegance that is within the prose itself.
Who knows? He might be saying the same thing.
Yeah, who knows?
He's flattered by the comparison.
Who knows?
Well, next year, your name, which isn't your real name.
Well, it is. It's actually not my birth name. I mean, I was born a different name and I changed it legally when I was 18, like the day after I went to the courthouse, and I changed my first, middle, and last name. It's completely made up. Augustine X. Burroughs. I mean, no one is born with this name. And no, not after William Burroughs. I'd never heard of William Burroughs.
Was it to protect your family as well?
No, it was not to protect my family because, I mean, I didn't know I was going to write anything. Right. It was because I didn't want to be a product of my childhood. I didn't want to have to be the same boy that went through what I went through. I wanted to start over.
Right. But your name, Augustine Burroughs, and your story are going to be on the big screen. Your first book, Television, and then Running with Scissors, your memoir, have been optioned for film. Who's going to play you?
You know, who's going to play me? I don't know. They want to find an unknown actor to play me, but they've got Julianne Moore in the role of my mother, and they have Brian Cox in the role of my mother's psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist's daughter, and who was also his receptionist, will be Gwyneth Paltrow.
This is a dream come true for you, who, as we read, used to dream in second grade that you were going to be the star of the Tang commercial.
I know. And you know what I get to do in the movie?
What?
I get to play a mental patient. And that is like the role that I never have to do research for. I mean, I know. I've been in a psychiatric hospital, yeah. So I'll thrive in that role.
Augustine Burroughs, author of the new book, Magical Thinking, True Stories, also author of Running with Scissors and Dry. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. We salute veterans on this Veteran Day. Join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.